From downtown Milwaukee, welcome to Money Talk with Bob Landis. Each week, professional advisors from Landis & Company Investments discuss the latest financial developments, offering timely insight and long-term perspective.
This is Money Talk for February 19th, 2021. Your Milwaukee Bucks are home for the entire week, and a few thousand fans will get to watch them live and in person at the Forum. Let's start with a 48-year-old man who was busted for proposing to his girlfriend with a ring he stole from his other girlfriend. Just to clarify, it's not against the law to propose to two women, but it is kind of stupid. What is illegal is stealing an engagement ring from one girl and giving it to another. Remember the old adage, with age comes wisdom? Let's hope it's true for this 18-year-old girl from Oklahoma. She called the cops on the bar that took away her fake ID. She demanded the bar give it back. Well, darling, here's a hint. No matter how good your fake ID is, that's not how this works. An Illinois man tried to steal a tow truck with the driver still in it. The wannabe thief then called the cops. Just to be clear, the thief called the cops to complain because the truck driver pulled the gun on him. This crook should hook up with the fake ID girl. A man is back in prison for carjacking a 16-year-old girl just 20 minutes after his release from prison. Apparently, you can't order an Uber from jail. Japan's ruling party now invites women to look but not talk at important key meetings. Japan, welcome to the 14th century. And finally, the Champlain, Minnesota police are asking people to refrain from having sex in their cars. The cops believe because of the pandemic, people are having trouble finding some alone time. But no matter your age, this simple rule still applies. If the cars are rocking, don't come a-knocking. On the podcast today, we have Dave Sandstrom, Chris Evers, Joel Dreesing, and wrapping up the week, here's Kyle Tedding.
Well, thank you as always, Max. A bit of a mixed week overall for the markets. The NASDAQ lost 1.6%, closing today at 13,874. The S&P 500 down 0.7%, closing at 3907. And the Dow Jones Industrial Average up 1 point today, virtually flat for the day, closing at the bell at 31,495, up 0.1% for the week. So we did manage to add a few nickels on the Dow, in large part due to the fact that it's as concentrated as it is. It's just 30 stocks as opposed to those broader S&P and NASDAQ benchmarks. So overall for the year, the Dow now up 3.1%, the S&P 500 now up 4.2%, the NASDAQ up 7.7%. Obviously a great start to the year, now a little more than a month and a half in. And that's kind of a quick look at markets in this 4-day trading week. As we look at, Joel, maybe just jumping off here, some of the economic data for the week, and in particular, one that's going to hit home for Chris here on the podcast as he's actively searching. But quite a bit of housing data this week, and some more of the same, and maybe some signs that things might be getting a little better in some places.
Yeah, Kyle, we had numbers from the National Association of Realtors today that showed that existing home sales, so that's the vast majority of what we look at in the housing market, that those rose again in January, and they're up like 24% from this time last year. That's at an annual rate. They're saying that it's the low interest rates, the mortgage rates are really low, and that there's increased demand for housing just because of the pandemic. I mean, people are staying at home more, they're working from home more, they want to be more comfortable, they want bigger places. So there's, more demand, and the low interest rates wasn't hurt by the economic stimulus payments that came in the last month or so from Congress. And the realtors are saying that, with another round of payments, that should help too, and help the economy, because there'll be more people working, and that's good for housing. The one thing that they're saying is holding back housing sales is inventory. And we've been hearing that for a couple of years now, 3 or 4 years now, that the realtors have been saying that there just aren't enough houses for sale. As a consequence of that, the year-to-year increase in housing prices has been going up for 107 months in a row. So, you know, at some point that's got to start pricing people out of the market. They're not going to be able to afford the house that they want. But we also had a report this week from the Department of Commerce showing that building permits and housing starts were looking good as far as building up inventory, especially when you look at those single family houses. The building permits are as high as they were in August of 2006. The completions and the houses under construction, they're as robust as they were just before the last recession in late 2007. So things are looking good for the housing market. You know, there are those questions along the way of keeping up, especially, you know, the housing prices are something to look at. And the realtors also pointed out that maybe interest rates are going to go up later this year. You know, there's more concern about inflation, especially if Congress is going to be adding, you know, a couple trillion dollars here or there to what the government is spending.
Chris, I hate to put you on the spot here, but how's your search going?
I'll tell you, it's a great time to be selling a house. You know, that as Joel said, you know, I could speak to, you know, lack of inventory. There's not that many homes on the market, obviously still probably a little early in the spring season. But, you know, for my specific, you know, anecdote, sample size of one, you know, most homes are that we're looking at. I mean, if it's on the market for more than 5 or 6 days, you're starting to wonder what's wrong with that home. You know, almost every home within 24 hours of being fully listed is going sold, and maybe 10,000-15,000 over list is pretty common. Cash offers are out there in a lot of instances. So it's a great time to be selling a home, maybe not a great time to be among the masses looking to purchase a home for all the reasons that Joel listed. But absolutely, the low interest rates is playing a big role in that as well. I mean, if you just compare the numbers of, you know, purchasing a home at, you know, current mortgage rates of, you know, 2.6 or 2.8, whatever your mortgage ends up being, 2.6, 2.8, compared that to historically a mortgage rate of 4.5 or 5.5, you could buy a home for, you know, $100,000 more than a home back at that interest rate and have the same monthly payment, same total payment over the course of the loan because you're paying so much less in interest. So it does make a huge difference for affordability for a lot of buyers, and it kind of opens up the market for a lot of people.
And it's really hard to understate the importance of a robust housing market and its value to the economy. You know, just so many things. It's so far reaching, especially with new constructions and the employment opportunities and the expansive you know, spill over to, you know, home improvement stores and landscapers and everything else. But I think one of the most important things to note during this particular one is the value of homes going up, and that wealth effect that provides for people that are homeowners gives them that kind of that, you know, security blanket in the back of their mind that my, you know, all of a sudden I have all this extra equity in my home now. You know, you go back to 2008 and the last large recession, you know, we had the opposite thing happen. We had pricing collapse. And boy, did that create havoc in the housing market and so many people forced to be underwater on their mortgages and walk away. You know, we have the opposite thing going on right now. And that's creating a much more positive situation in the economy.
And Dave, that wealth effect, actually, I mean, you know, it's not necessarily that you are wealthier, it's just that you feel it, right? I mean, it's because a lot of that, I mean, you know, the equity in people's houses isn't cash in their pocket necessarily as you know, with their investments.
And to tie that back to 08, I mean, if you think about the run-up in home prices prior to 08, I think something really important to differentiate this time around as housing prices are growing considerably. If you look at the loan profile of who's borrowing money to purchase homes right now, the credit rating profile is very, very strong. So this is not an instance where banks are lending money to low credit quality borrowers, you know, people putting little to no cash down. This is for the most part very high, you know, very high credit quality loans. There's not as much risk within the housing market, even though prices are going up. So I think maybe there's a somewhat of a knee-jerk reaction to think of, oh, home prices are really going up quickly. there could be some excess risk taking. That's not really the case right now, based on looking at the data.
Well, I know that from some of what I've read, it appears that a few of those folks that jumped at houses at the beginning of this pandemic, thinking that they were done with city life, may now be regretting some of those decisions as things start to open back up. I also know, Chris, that if you're having trouble finding a fixed home, that a home on wheels may be an option for you as well. And even those are hard to find right
those are
now.
Tough, yeah.
Stories of RVs, mobile homes, those kinds of things being in pretty high demand right now as well. So it's not even just single family residences. I think there's some area specific issues, especially if you want to get out of the city right now. You know, Joel, as we look at some of the other economic data this week, obviously employment continues to be maybe the most important thing driving so much of what happens with the next leg of potential economic recovery. You know, if you can't put more people back to work, it tells you a lot about how healthy the economy really is.
That's Kyle. That's right, Kyle. And as we've said in the past few weeks, and we expect the economy to rebound faster than employment, and that has caused some concern for Janet Yellen, the Secretary of Treasury, and for the chair of the Federal Reserve, Jerome Powell. They've both said that having people unemployed looking for work for a long time is just really a drag long term on the economy. But we are seeing some signs that that's getting better. Even the people who have jobs, we heard from Walmart in the last 24 hours that they're planning on raising the average wage for their workers. So all of that helps fuel, what really is driving our economy, and that's consumer spending. And then we get back to the things like the wealth effect, like Dave was talking about before, where people feel more confident and they're spending more money. We had numbers this week on retail spending. That was up for the first time in 4 months, again, kind of following those economic stimulus payments, in the last few weeks. And every single category rose in revenue from December. And some of them are like, double digit from a year ago, just because there was so much spending that was put off because of the pandemic.
And I think it's important you mentioned the Walmart, potential raises, and you look at why they're talking about giving raises. It's entirely because they had a good fourth quarter of earnings, and all of a sudden they've got way more money than they thought they were going to have. And so it's incredible how those things fit together, right? That if as a business, you've got more money coming in, short term, you don't know what to do with that money. You want to lock down, right, profits. You want to lock down your long-term viability. But the longer that those profits persist, the more that labor can go, okay, maybe we deserve a little bit of that. And that's kind of the tug of war we have right now, is there's so much unemployment out there that businesses maybe don't have to raise wages. But at the same time, there's a lot of businesses making a lot of money who are finding out that they can, and there's lots of reasons why they want to. I think the other big one that came out this week was some data on manufacturing, industrial production. And I think what really has stood out to me is how well manufacturers have weathered this latest recession. Typically, manufacturers hit pretty hard in recessions. This, a very different recession, and maybe in that regard.
Yeah, and it reminds me of what Chris said before. I mean, really coming into this recession, the economy was relatively strong. So, the consumers do have pretty good credit ratings, and they've got, some cash set aside as dry powder. And so manufacturing has rebounded pretty quickly. They figured out very soon after the shutdowns from the pandemic, how to reconfigure their manufacturing space, how to do things more, efficiently. Unfortunately, in some cases, maybe with fewer employees, but they've been figuring that out. Numbers this week from the Federal Reserve show that industrial output is almost back to where it was back in February, before the pandemic really shut things down. Manufacturing is the biggest part of that industrial production.
And some news on producer prices, and maybe a good segue to a bit of a conversation about inflation. I think the producer price index, the consumer price index, personal consumption expenditures, all the kind of typical measures of inflationary pressure within the system, they're not pointing to much that has happened, not pointing to much that's currently happening outside of maybe some gas prices and a couple of other areas. But the market is starting to anticipate some signs of inflation down the road.
Yeah, Kyle, those are really sort of temporary things. The gas going up by double digit, percentages from the year before, things like that. But one of the numbers that's in the industrial production numbers is the capacity utilization rate. So how much of a percentage of factories, utilities are being used at one time. That went to a record low back in April when everything shut down. They've come back up, but they're still not anywhere near their long-term average. It's like 76% utilization rate right now, and the long-term average is closer to 80%. We haven't been at 80% since 2008, so before the first recession, or in the middle of the last recession. That's the last time that we were producing close to our long-term average. So yeah, you look at some of those inflation numbers and it looks like things are perking up, but this capacity utilization rate is one area where it says, maybe not so much.
And what I appreciate, I think, about some of these inflation measures is we can be more forward-looking. We can digest some of, we call them transient impacts, right? Things that year over year look much worse than they really are if you start to smooth them out. Gasoline prices being a big one. You'll see the cost of, a number of services take pops at points in time this year, simply because of how depressed things were last year. And so on a year over year basis, things look pretty bad. If you smooth that out over 2 or 3 years, things start to look a little bit less intense in terms of the inflationary pressure. But we are seeing now, the yield on the 10-year treasury took another big jump this week. We ended last week at 1.2%. We finished this week at 1.35. And I think more importantly, we can look at the break-even rates for inflation over 5 years, 10 years, and that's really a measure of what the market expects for inflation to be over those periods of time. The 5-year break even right now is 2.29% and 2.16% for the 10-year. Those are big jumps from where we ended the year. Keep in mind, that's barely over the Fed's 2% target. So that maybe isn't a sign that inflation is going to take off, but it's absolutely a sign that inflation may be able to get back to a more normal rate. As we look out a couple of years, as we digest some of the issues that we have here. And, I think that begs the question, how do we manage some of that inflation, and B, what do we do about it within our portfolios? Chris, I know, maybe you for the first one, Dave, maybe you for the second, but both feel free to chime in wherever. One of the things I know you and I have talked about is how we've managed to keep inflation in check simply because of technological improvements.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. Technology is naturally disinflationary. And what I mean by that is, as businesses become more efficient in being able to produce goods using less inputs due to technology, that allows them to keep costs down, right? And that allows them to essentially go out and try to get more market share by competing on price. So that keeps the end price down for consumers. So areas of the market where there's a high amount of technology and competition and innovation. So you think of like hardware services, hardware as in like TVs or your phone or things like that. You go and think of how much drastic improvement there's been over the last decade or two in these hardware devices and what you actually get for your end product and the price that you pay. It's unbelievable when you think about, what you get additionally. So that type of technology keeps costs down. You even think of things as simple as software and, customer relationship management devices that allowed people to, within office spaces, no longer rely on, paper and sending out mass mailings and waiting for that to get back. That's reduced a whole lot of overhead. It keeps costs down and allows the end product that goes to the customer to be not as expensive to them. So there's a huge impact of technology. Now, obviously, there's some areas that technology doesn't impact quite as drastically or hasn't over, you know, the last decade or two. You know, the main ones probably being education and healthcare. And we could, you know, have a conversation about whether healthcare has had technology impacted, but it's just a matter of better outcomes, better results, better actual end results for the individual, but maybe not lower costs.
And Chris, I think what I love about that conversation is that there are so many businesses that benefit not just from, you know, better pricing power with the potential for inflation, but also that are doing things and making money, keeping inflation in check. The other side of that, of course, Dave, is that there's a number of places that we can go, you know, as inflation returns to a more normal rate. Or, you know, maybe potentially moves beyond normal for, you know, a short period of time, depending on what kinds of impact some of these things we're talking about have. But, you know, there's places that you can go within your portfolio to navigate that. I'm sure that clients are asking you about that all the time.
Yeah, that's for sure, Kyle. And especially when you couple that, you know, in current markets with very low interest rates and fixed income possibilities, it also forces people to try to look for other opportunities. So not just just the inflation question, but, you know, people looking to some of these alternative investments, a lot of them that do address inflation. You talk about treasury and inflation protected securities, or TIPS as they're called. You talk about real assets that would be in the line of commodities and real estate and other tangible type assets. And there are some opportunities out there, Kyle, I think. But I caution people to also take note of, in times like this, you see a lot of investment ideas coming forward because people are looking, right? And where can I go to find something like this? Or where can I go to get some yield? And a lot of the alternative space is unfortunately can be dominated by expensive strategies, illiquid strategies, and even some unregulated strategies. These are not your typical stocks and bonds. The SEC doesn't have quite the power to regulate some of those types of investments. So I caution investors to be careful there and look to get some strong advice when they're looking at real assets or inflation protection before they get into something that they regret at some point.
And I, you know, maybe stress that one of the best ways to combat inflation is to buy stocks, that especially stocks with pricing power, whether that's financials. If inflation takes off, interest rates should rise, which helps banks' bottom lines. Whether it's companies that have fairly low input costs with some pricing power. And the good news is a big part of our markets here in the U.S. is technology stocks. Those technology stocks have a ton of pricing power and very low input costs in terms of, you know, marginal users. And so I think as much as, you know, we want to have a conversation about, well, if inflation does take off, what are we going to do about it? I think there's three really important things to remember. One is, you've already done something about it by holding stocks in your portfolio. And in particular, you know, I think we've tended to overweight those areas of the market that I think are a little bit more, a little stronger businesses, a little bit stronger revenue. You know, two is that, you know, we're not talking about inflation taking off. We're talking about inflation returning to normal. And so that's a very different thing. You know, the third piece of that is that those items that you would look at in an environment in which inflation really does take off, you know, commodities or, you know, other hard assets, things that, you know, tend to need high inflation for meaningful price growth, you know, they aren't going to benefit in an environment in which growth is slow, inflation is normal. You know, they need more than that. And so there are places in your portfolio for that stuff, certainly from a risk diversifying perspective, Dave, as you rightfully mentioned. This is a tough environment for rates. It's a tough environment for bonds. And so how do you navigate risk? You spread it out a little more than you otherwise would, more outside the U.S., more in diversified investments. But beyond that, you know, I think we want to be very careful that we're not responding to a threat that maybe isn't as real as what some people who want to sell you something would have you believe.
Yeah, as much as none of us really want to see high levels of inflation, I think it, as you've kind of indicated, Kyle, it's important to note that some level of inflation is not bad. And, you know, having a level of inflation that's more normal in the economy, be that, you know, 2 to 2.5%, what that mostly signals is a healthy economy where there is economic growth and there's people out there spending money. You know, I think a bigger fear for the last couple of years here now has been what happens if we get deflation, and that's a result of people not spending money and prices go down, because that results in a, you know, really ugly outcome. So, you know, I don't want us to panic over, you know, getting a 2% reading on inflation or a slight uptick in interest rates. You know, I'm thinking back to kind of 2015, 2016, as we talked about a normalization of interest rates. And the topic then was, yes, interest rates might be going up, but they're going up to get back to a normal level so that the economy is working at an interest rate level that is more normal. They're not raising rates to end the party, so to speak. And there's a big difference there. And I think that's important to also know with inflation. There's a big difference between having a 2% inflation because the economy is growing at a healthy clip, or having a 4 to 6% inflation because, you know, commodity prices or oil prices are out of control. That, you know, we're not really talking about the latter. We're talking more so about the former in this situation.
All great points for sure. Well, as always, we enjoy doing the program for you, and we will talk to you again next week.
Thank you for listening to Money Talk with Bob Landis. If you have a financial question you want answered on next week's show, email it to moneytalk@landis.com. To keep informed throughout the week, visit our Money Talk page at landis.com.